Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is the October meeting of the Talk of Iowa Book Club. We have been reading An American Marriage by Tayari Jones. It was published in 2018 and rocketed to the bestseller lists thanks to endorsements from Oprah Winfrey and Barack Obama. It tells the story of Celestial and Roy Hamilton. At the beginning of the book, they're living in Atlanta, Georgia, with bright futures ahead of them. They are young, in love, educated, and professional. Roy is a marketing executive on the rise, and Celestial is a gifted artist who's starting to get noticed. Then their lives are upended when Roy is accused and convicted of rape, a crime he did not commit. A crime Celestial knows he did not commit. He goes to prison, where he spends 5 years before his conviction is overturned. Roy, Celestial, and their marriage are transformed by the ordeal, and we get to be there along with them as they try to put the pieces of their lives back together to find a new path forward. This is Tayari Jones's fourth novel. She grew up in Georgia, attended Spelman College, and is a graduate of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. In a few minutes, I'll bring a couple of expert readers into the conversation. But first, Stephanie Jones is here. She is an assistant professor of education at Grinnell College and founder of the Mapping Racial Trauma in Schools Project. She also hails from Georgia. Stephanie, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for being part of this. And I would love for you to start us off by reading just a short excerpt from the book.
Well, I selected a short excerpt from Roy's point of view. If you have the paperback, it's on page 11 at the bottom. And he's talking about kind of the dynamic between him and his wife, Celestial. It starts, "The thing is this, it's a challenge being 2.0. On paper, we're a different world. Where are they now? Whitley and Dwayne all grown up. But Celestial and me are something Hollywood never imagined. She was gifted, and I was her manager and muse. It's not like I lay around in my birthday suit so she can draw me. No, I simply lived my life and she watched. When we were engaged, she won a competition for a glass sculpture she created. From a distance, it looked to be a shooter marble. But when you got up close and looked from the right angle, you can make out the lines of my profile swirled inside. Somebody offered her $5,000 for it, but she wouldn't part with it. This isn't what happens when a marriage is in danger. She did for me, and I did for her in return. Back in the day when you worked so your wife didn't have to, they call that sitting your woman down. It was a goal of Big Roy's to sit Olive down, but it never quite worked out. In his honor, and maybe for my own, I worked all day so that Celestial could stay home making dolls, her primary art medium. I'm into museum quality marbles and the delicate line drawings, but the dolls were something that an ordinary person could get behind. My vision was a line of cloth dolls that we were going to sell wholesale. You could display them on a shelf or hug the stuffing out of them. There would still be the high-end custom jobs and art pieces. Those could fetch five figures easy. But the everyday dolls were going to make her mark, I told her. And you see, I turned out to be right. I know that all of this is water under the bridge and not a sweet little creek either. But to be fair, I have to tell this whole story. We were married only a year and some change, but it was a good year. Even she would have to admit that."
Stephanie Jones reading from An American Marriage by Tayari Jones. And Stephanie, a lot of us discovered Tayari Jones when this book was published. Oprah told us all to read it. But at that point, you were already a fan, weren't you?
Absolutely. I hail from Atlanta, Georgia. So Tayari Jones is a household name as far as I'm concerned. So I've been reading her work for a while.
So when you first read this book, tell me what your response was.
Oh, Lord. I think when I got my hands on this book, first of all, anything that Tayari Jones comes out with, I'm reading. That's number one. Second of all, I know when a book stays with me, when I refuse to put it down and I sacrifice other things that I'm doing to make sure that it can be read in one sitting. So it took me about 2 days to read the hardcover copy of this book. And there are moments of this book that are still with me, you know, 2-3 years later.
Yeah. So rereading it, was there anything that struck you different this time?
I think what struck me different was Teyari's ability to introduce a character to me that I'd already been, you know, that I've already been introduced to. And it was almost like I was meeting Roy and Celestial for the first time again. And I love how she's able to craft that new vision of putting a new character in front of us. And then it all leads to this one scene in the book that I think is a pivotal scene in the book that I think changes the energy in the book between the characters. And I loved going on that journey with her again to how they ended up at that point.
I found myself a little apprehensive when I started again, because I had read the book before and this time I knew what was coming and I had a hard time getting to the point where Roy was arrested. And then I was able to get past it, and it just draws you in, and there's so much going on with every character on every level. There's so much nuance to this book. And I've listened to a number of interviews that she's given about the book, and her project started. She wanted to write a book about mass incarceration, and it just wasn't going anywhere. Then she went shopping with her mom at a mall in Atlanta, and she overheard this heated conversation between this couple, a very attractive, professional-looking couple, and the woman said to the man, "Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me for 7 years." And he said, "I don't know what you're talking about. This wouldn't have happened to you in the first place." And that was the spark. I mean, those lines are in the book. It's just such an extraordinary origin story.
Absolutely. And to reread it and see Celestial almost predicting that something is going to happen tonight that we don't want to happen. And her almost giving this ominous prediction, like, hey, we need to just follow our gut and do something different. And then we ignore those things all the time. But it brings up this idea of why we even call the book, or why Teyari even called the book, An American Marriage. There's something uniquely American and devastating and tragic about having this be a possibility in anyone's life story.
Yeah. And you mentioned you're from Atlanta. Teyari Jones is from Atlanta. The novel takes place in Atlanta, at least a lot of it does. And that's a really important element of this book. Help me understand culture in Atlanta and how that plays into this novel.
Well, I want to go back and quote Rudine Sims Bishop, who's a children's literature scholar. And she talks about the need for having windows and mirrors in our books, that we need to be able to see into other people, but we also need to see a reflection of ourselves. And that's why I love Teyari Jones's work, is because I can literally sit in my house in Atlanta and read a novel with the streets and the schools that are around the corner from me inside of this book. And so there's this knowing that she has, that I have as a Black person living in Atlanta, about our rich culture and our rich history. If our listeners have never been to Atlanta or know the history of Atlanta, in our community, it's a Black Mecca. You know, it means something to be able to grow up in a space where you see Black communities, Black people, Black marriages, Black families thriving, and thriving at every single level imaginable. And it's not until you possibly leave Atlanta and go other places that you see how much of a gift Atlanta is. And it's no wonder that people flock there to be able to get an experience with this culture. So she's given us a glimpse of just the richness and the very humanity of what Black people go through in this world. So I love reading it.
Well, and that's what gives Celestial and Roy the opportunity to pursue their dreams in all their fullness and to feel confident that they can go forward. And they talk about having kids someday and not having to tell their kids the same things their parents told them. You know, they don't ever want to say to their child, "You have to work twice as hard to get half as far." And I mean, it's part of that culture. I'm sure at some points, it's felt to people almost post-racial culture, which we know is not really a thing in this country, but they have that optimism in their lives.
Yeah. I mean, that optimism is a part of, you know, what we call, you know, radical dreaming. This is our way of freedom dreaming with our families, to where we can say, hey, you know what? Even though my parents had to tell me I had to be twice as good to be half as accepted as other people, maybe that won't be the reality for you. But also, I think Tayari gently, maybe forcibly reminds us that in this sense of an American marriage, racism, anti-Blackness, and white supremacy does not take a day off. And so you're going to be reminded of that. And then how do we prepare our families? How do we engage in our relationships so that we have that understanding, but we're still able to live full lives? It's such a contradiction at times, and it's stressful, and it's hurtful, and it's painful. But we have hope, and we continue to dream about things being better for us than they were for the people before us.
One of the things that I know really moved you about this book is that it is a love story about Black Americans. So tell me why that feels so powerful to you.
I think even as I watch television in 2021, I'm very hard pressed to come across two Black people who actually like each other and are in love with each other. And I should not be that hard pressed to find it. And so it's a radical, first of all, the idea of love is radical. Second of all, the idea of love being radical when you have a history of people trying to other you, trying to dehumanize you, saying that you're going to love anyway in the midst of all of that is even more radical. And so I feel like having a Black love story again, is that mirror and that window that I want to see and that I know is possible. And so what happens when we have our literature, when we have television, when we have media being able to portray these images of things that we already know that we do, right? like we're not perpetuating the stereotype that a lot of people associate with Black families, but knowing that we are out here and that we're loving each other is something that we always want to have reaffirmed because it exists and we still do it.
We are talking about An American Marriage by Tayari Jones. With me, Stephanie Jones of Grinnell College. We're going to meet our other expert readers in just a moment. This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com. This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. I'm Charity Nebbe. We have been reading An American Marriage by Tayari Jones. It is a love story warped by racial injustice. It follows Roy and Celestial, a young Black professional couple living their dreams in Atlanta, Georgia, until Roy is convicted of a crime he did not commit and sent to prison, where he stays for 5 years before his conviction is overturned. With me to talk about the book, Stephanie Jones. She's an assistant professor of education at Grinnell College and the founder of the Mapping Racial Trauma in Schools Project. And it is time to meet our other expert readers today. Andre Wright is here. He is an activist, fashion designer, and entrepreneur. He is co-founder and CEO of Humanize My Hoodie. Hello, Andre.
Hello. I'm excited to be here and honored to be amongst the company of Stephanie and Keisha.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here. And I know this is the first time you read the book, Andre. So tell me, what was your reaction to it?
When I first read it, I could see correlations to things that's happened in my life. I've been happily married with my wife for 15 years now. I got 3 kids. And so I could see all kinds of trauma that's happened through my life. But then also I could see beautiful moments as well. And as, you know, the characters were described, I could see you know, my aunt in one character, and I could see my father-in-law in one character. I could see all these different things that you know, that I was familiar with as I read the book. So yeah, there was a number of ways that I was relative to what they were talking about. So
it felt true.
Yeah, it felt real. It felt really real.
Our other expert reader here is Keisho Scott. She is an internationally renowned diversity trainer and consultant and an associate professor of American Studies and Sociology at Grinnell College, among other things. Keisho, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here and to be asked to do something that I hardly am ever asked to do, and that's to say something about literary analysis, which I know nothing about. However, these microists who are looking at the relationships, I got something to say about the institutions that back this book. And so I'm glad to be able to contribute.
Yeah. Well, and Keisho, when you sat down and started reading this book, it hit really close to the bone. You threw it across the room, you told me. Tell me about your reaction.
This book hit very close to home because my children's father was an incarcerated African-American man who was involved and charged with the crimes that really the political groups that I was involved in, you know, he took the rap, let's say it like that, right? He took the rap for those groups. And so he didn't come out the same. So this was very close to home. I'm talking about my children's father. I'm seeing glimpses of that. And this is the first time I have ever talked about that in any kind of public venue. So putting aside that, it was close to personal home. But where it was close to social home and academic home for me is that this book is taking place between about the late 1979 till really about 1981. And this is a pivotal period where black power emerges after civil rights, community control emerges in the African-American community, the rise of black capitalism and entrepreneurism in a powerful way. And the anti-colonial movements are happening all over Africa. Not just the rise of black feminism is taking a powerful space to talk beyond white feminist voices, and the black queer movement is banging. So all this is happening. Why wouldn't this couple feel successful? And by the way, now they're mirroring my life because, you know, I wanted to have one. My second marriage was like them. So it does hit home, right?
Well, and I do want to acknowledge that I asked all of you to do a lot of emotional labor in reading this book. I mean, it's a brilliant novel, but there's a lot of really difficult subject matter. So I really appreciate your willingness and your vulnerability. Let's talk a little bit more about love, because Stephanie, we already started talking about how this is a love story between two Black Americans, and that's beautiful. But there is so many love stories involved in this novel. I mean, it goes so far beyond Celestial and Roy. So give me your thoughts about that, because we see the interactions of so many individuals and different kinds of love, too.
Absolutely. I feel like when we think about Roy's parents, Olive and Big Roy, I mean, we see this example of love that is couched in a very traditional way, right? Just this idea of, you know, sitting your wife at home, right? You working so that she does not have to work. And then taking, you have to think about the way in which when a couple gets together and then they raise a child, they are showing that child their idea of what love is, right? And then how they bring that forth into their future relationships. It's just this genealogy of love that we need to explore. So then, of course, Roy is thinking, well, I'm going to treat you the way that I saw my father treat my mother, right? But see, Celestial didn't have that type of love. It was a different kind of love from her parents. And so what happens when you find your person, you find the person that you love, and you realize that you know how to love in different ways? And then what happens when you realize that no matter how much you love a person, you won't know everything about them? And that's what tripped me up about this book, is that regardless if they're married for a year and a half, regardless if they're married for 30 years or 50 years, do you really know everything about the person you choosing to share your life with? And I think those are the questions that Tayari is just dropping and making us deal with. And I love her for that.
Well, and I really loved seeing Roy's parents and their loving relationship, and seeing Celestial's parents and their loving relationship, which, you know, was, as you just said, Stephanie, a different kind of loving relationship. And we'll talk about parent-child relationships too, but that, you know, the unconditional love from the parents, even though maybe they don't agree with decisions that their kids are making. And there are so many levels here. Andre, you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you made some really good points there, Stephanie, and I'm just, now I'm looking at my life, I'm like, do I really know my wife? Like, you know, like, it just made me, it made me start analyzing my stuff. And I mean, really, I'm being sincere when I say that. I mean, like, I really started to think, I'm like, yeah, man, maybe is there some skeletons in my closet that I need to unleash also, right? Like, is it things that, you know, because as two people that love each other, we were brought up in two different family dynamics, right? Like, my family was very old school. They from Durant, Mississippi, and they had very different ways of raising me and how to show how I was able to love, right? And I got loved a different way than my wife got loved from her family. They had more things, right? Like, they had more stuff, you know, and I had to be creative with my love. So it just, when you just mentioned that, it just made me think about my own reaction and my own, like, life in love is not a monolith for us. Like, we all aren't the same people. Like, it's, we love differently in different kind of ways for, to whoever that is, right? Like, my love for my mom might be different than my love for my mother-in-law. Not that I love her any different. I just show it different because this is my mom. I got a different way of showing you how I love her versus how I would show how I love my mother-in-law. So it just made me think about that.
So let me add this. So since we, our love was born, shaped, and always impacted by systems that didn't allow us to really be free emotionally, traumatized by the legacy of slavery and the selling of our children, the raping of our bodies, the taking away of our ability to marry, to be educated, our love also has always felt obligatory.
That's real.
Come on now.
And in that obligation, that connection is this, we're going to see throughout the story that that's one of the dynamics that they were always dealing with. I'm a social scientist. That means I got a love in relationship to what? Marriage, when 50% of all marriages end in divorce in the United States. When 41% of the first marriages in this country end in divorce, and that Black women have a higher rate of divorce than any other group. So I'm trying to understand that we stay in relationships because we know that these relationships protect the community. They protect men. They protect women. They protect children. And so it's not just personal love, but it's also love of the race. I grew up clearly knowing that part of my responsibility was to love my race. That meant I loved it through that man. I loved it through my grandparents. I loved it definitely through my sisters. And all of that was obligatory, right? And I think that this story is about some of that love, right? And those blurred relationships in that love that didn't fit neat packages. And them, clearly, Andre being convicted, put in prison, his marriage could not go, the genie could not go back in the bottle. And that's what an element of this story is about. How does the love be impacted when the genie can't go in the bottle, when the marriage can't sustain itself, the personal marriage, but the relationships of obligation do have to sustain themselves for all of us to benefit. And I think that that makes, she is brilliant to write this story with us facing those questions. And finally, I want to add one more thing. This is important. You know, love happens during social movements. Love moves social movements, right? People fall in love, and you can go back and look at stories of that. So in a way, they're benefiting from the privilege of the social movements that impacted their life, right? And they have every reason to think they're going to fly, right? Except just because you're highly educated and you're a social mobile Black person don't mean you're going to be protected from the things that our professor here said, institutionalized racism, anti-Black racism, and white supremacy.
I want to say something, Mama Keisho, about what you said. I hope you don't mind me calling you Mama Keisho. when you talk about that obligation piece, I think that that's something that needs to be broken open as it relates to Celestial's character, because we have to think that, like, Black women right now, single Black women right now, people are not talking to us enough about how we are conceiving of marriage, how we are conceiving of relationships. And at this point, a lot of us are thinking, like, does that obligation that I have to my community, to my race, to my partner, does it benefit me or does it exhaust me?
Does it supersede all my personal freedoms?
Hey, come on now. And so when we think about that, there are a lot of decisions that Celestial is making in the book that Roy does not understand. And she's making them on behalf of her existence, her own perseverance, that I want to be able to stay alive. I want to be able to stay well. I want to put myself first. And so when we think about that in a conversation with obligation, what happens if Black women choose themselves? And how do people feel about that?
Yes, yes, yes.
You were talking about obligatory love, which makes me think about the one character in this story that is not obliged to do what he did. And that is Big Roy, who was a really just remarkable character. And maybe there are so many nuances. Nobody in this book is perfect except for maybe Big Roy. Roy, the main character in the book, is his mother, Olive, has him with another man who splits and is not part of the scene and falls in love with Big Roy, who will take her as she is and knows that, you know, he wants her. And that means also he wants her son, and he is willing to put himself fully into this relationship and be a father. They rename Little Roy so that he is now Big Roy's junior. And it's this really beautiful relationship. And but we also see Roy struggling with that. That's one of the early conflicts in the story, because he needs to tell Celestial that Big Roy is not his biological father, and that, you know, if they're going to start a family together, she needs to know that, and that there are other factors in play that aren't visible to the eye. And Andre, I know that was a part of the story that really touched you. Tell me why that resonated so strongly with you in thinking about Roy figuring out who he is, in thinking about both his father and his biological father.
Yeah, I would say it touched me because it was almost too close to home for me, right? And in my own personal life, but then also in many of my colleagues and friends that I know who didn't grow up with their biological father, who had someone step in and be somewhat of a father figure to them, you know? And so it just made me think about my life and, like, man, shout out to Big Roy. He was like the oracle. He knew what was going on. He knew about Andre. He knew about all these things. And he was trying to, like, he let little Roy Jr. like kind of live his life, but he was like telling him along the way, like, hey man, you need to pay attention to this. Hey, you need to see if you still married when you come home. Hey, you need to figure out, do you still love this girl? He was even when he went and got some on the side while he was still married, he didn't let him live that long, right? He had about an hour to like celebrate the whole fact that, hey man, you just got home and you got some, but hey man, you better go check to see if you still married, because I don't know if you still married. So that whole dynamic was very personal. Not to the point where I would break down in tears, but it just made me think about like the role of your biological father and like what their role is and how important for us as Black men to play that role and be that foundation for all of our kids. You know, when I say all of our kids, that means like all the kids that I see every day that I can be a father to, even if I'm not their biological father, right? I could be somewhat of a father figure to them in some kind of sense, shape, or form or fashion. So
in this moment that we're living in, the racial reckoning, you know, and we're talking about white privilege, that isn't the only meaningful privilege that has an impact. And biological father is one of those privileges in our community, given the history of racism, where you didn't even know who your mama was forced to sleep with as a slave, probably her master and everybody else. Her body didn't belong to her. So after the end of slavery, having your biological father was the privilege we gave each other, right? And many Black families protected that to the end. And by the way, I don't care what the data talks about in the popular media, the majority of Black kids still are with their biological parents. It is a myth that 80% of our families are broken up. That's just a myth, right? In reality. So I love what you said, Andre, because it touches home. I am of historical generational divorce, right? We got to see where privilege, where we have stole privilege, and where we also build on a society that doesn't protect our institutions.
There is so much more to talk about. We are talking about An American Marriage by Tayari Jones. This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. We'll be back in a moment.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. I'm Charity Nebbe. We have been reading An American Marriage by Tayari Jones. It is a love story between two people, Roy and Celestial. They are young, professional, Black, living their dreams in Atlanta until Roy is convicted of a crime he did not commit and sent to prison. His 5 years in prison changes everything for this couple and for many of the other people in their lives. And with me to talk about the book, Andre Wright. He is an activist, fashion designer, and entrepreneur, co-founder and CEO of Humanize My Hoodie. Keisho Scott is an internationally renowned diversity trainer and consultant and associate professor of American Studies and Sociology at Grinnell College. And Stephanie Jones, she is an assistant professor of education at Grinnell College and the founder of the Mapping Racial Trauma in Schools Project. Stephanie, we were talking about parentage. We were talking about Big Roy, who is the stepfather slash adoptive father of Little Roy. And he just is the personification of unconditional love and acceptance. And, you know, he is so there for Roy in any way that he needs him. What did you want to add to that?
I just wanted to add that I recognized across the theme of what we were talking about is that there is this cultural practice that's also a theological practice as well that I think Black communities are amazing at and that we still do. But it's this phrase we call standing in the gap, right? And we know what it means to intercede on someone's behalf, to take care of someone who may not be able to be, you know, that can take care of themselves. And we do that out of love. Right? We just don't stand in a gap for anybody. We stand in a gap for our community, for ourselves, for our people. So I feel like Big Roy is a shining example of what it means to stand in a gap, but that all of the characters in some way have attempted to stand in a gap for each other. And how we know how to do that obviously comes from the type of community that we were raised in. But I think that process of being able to say, I got you, is that radical love that we've been speaking about this entire time. And that I think this is what Tayari Jones is challenging in all of us, is that do we recognize when people are standing in the gap for us? And do we recognize when some folks are just like, I can't stand here right now anymore? And those are real things that happen to all of us.
I think I would balance that out with the fact that, you know, there's this mantra has been historically in the African-American community, which we don't speak out loud because it can be misinterpreted, like we mad and angry and we upset and we ain't Americans and all kind of stuff we get named on. But you know what? Do you actually think we don't recognize that we on our own?
Come on now.
That we are on our own, that every institution that is supposed to have taken care of every other American hasn't taken care of us, right?
Hey, that's
and
real.
So therefore, just standing in the gap has been our way of privileging ourselves, right?
Absolutely.
Our way of being a mailman, you know, by day and a deacon by night in the church was a way we privileged ourselves by buying our wife a beautiful hat, you know, and the cost of that hat, you know, took over some of the electricity. She had to look good in the church, right, in the community to show that that person was loving. We've had strategies that we often don't talk about is showing our love. And we've not been afraid to do that. The thing that is disturbing to me today is the diminishment of that. And I think, Andre, I want you to wrap up on this when you start talking to me about the role of music and what certain kind of music has done to obscure those ways we privilege each other. I'm gonna stop talking and let you take over.
Yeah, and we mentioned that earlier, the music, and we look at Roy's situation, Roy Jr., and then we look at, he got a sexual assault. You know, they said he raped this woman, and we look at the music that we listen to today, and it perpetuates how the Black woman is looked at, right? Like they're looking at them as something other than what I see my mother as or my sister as. And I really never understood it, but I don't know if it's driven by money or if it's driven by popularity or what that's driven by. But a lot of it, like you said earlier, is systemic. It's systemic. Like like our culture, we love our mothers. We love our sisters. We love in all kinds of unconditional ways. But then when it comes to the entertainment piece, we never really show that through the music.
But the other thing is, if at a certain level in our community, we certainly had practices of handling things on our own before we turned over some of the contradictory elements in our community over to these institutions. I think about one of the most powerful things in Maya Angelou's book when she talks about being raped at 11 years old, you know, and how this had an impact. People in the community somehow took care of that, right? I mean, they didn't expect the police department, they did not expect the state to come and take care of one Black girl being raped. And by the way, let's not forget, the first white man was not convicted of rape in this country of a Black woman until 1967. So even our protection, we didn't expect these institutions to take care of us. But we're in a moment now, however, where we now expect these institutions to take care of elements of behavior in our community, and it has gone overboard. You know what I mean? Like policing, like controlling kids in school, like cutting off kids' hair, and all of these behaviors that we have all of a sudden turned over to these machineries that we used to step in the gap for. So, I mean, like, how do we make sense of how then that adds a level of pressure on love between two people, between community people? It adds a new layer because we're not sure where the enemy is anymore.
Hey, that's 100%, man. Say that. Say that, like, for real.
let me jump in real quick because I feel like what's necessary, and I don't want to ruin the end of the book for people who have not gotten to this point yet, but there is a really powerful act of remembering that happens here. And when we say remember, this is what I mean by that is we're saying we're remembering what we have forgotten, right? We're returning back to what we have forgotten. And when I think about the language that Esther Perel used on the Here to Slay podcast, where she talked about the reason why we are going through it so bad right now is because we are relying on one person in the community to do what the entire community used to do. And so when we think about what it means to remember what we have forgotten, it's Roy and Celestial remembering what it was that brought them together as a couple. It's our community realizing that we have done a harm to someone and we need to correct it, not throw them away. Right? We need to correct and repair that harm that we have done. And so until we get to a point where, like, the state will recognize the harm that it has done, which is probably, you know, if you could see my face right now, I have thoughts. But we also still, and this has been a Black tradition, is that we know that we cannot rely on that remembering to come from the oppressor, that it has to come from within our communities in terms of how we learn how to repair each other and how to repair our relationships. Because it's not until that happens that we can then tell other people about it.
And that repair can take place anywhere. Because what does Roy find himself in the prison cell with? He comes to find out that's his real, did you say biological father?
Yeah.
And that father played out that role of taking care of him in that prison, even though he didn't take care of him in the real world.
We know that Roy did not commit this crime. He is not a rapist. He spent 5 years in prison doing whatever he needed to do to stay alive. And when he got out of prison, he was asking himself some really hard questions about, who am I? Am I the same man that I was before? And she just explored that with so much nuance. And, you know, he comes to find that he is at the core of himself the same man that he was before, but he has been through so much. And you just, it beautifully illustrates how even when an innocent man or woman is put in this inhumane kind of condition, I mean, they could become what you treat them as while they go through this incredible ordeal. Andre, what were your thoughts on reading that?
I mean, with having so many friends formerly incarcerated, I understood Roy's struggle. Like, not that I can personally relate to it because I haven't been incarcerated, but from my friends, I've seen the changes. Like, them talk about them using the light just to keep the light on. They had to carry their own lights, and just little stuff like not being able to know certain things about the internet and text messaging and like how to adapt to get a job in today's society on top of all the things that we got to go through as Black people. Then to come out and be formally incarcerated and try to adapt to our current environment, I could just relate to it to a certain extent and understand how hard it was for him to try to rehabilitate himself and how much love and support he needed during that time, you know. And shout out to him for, you know, being able to go through those flames and try to regenerate who he was, right, as a person and try to get his love back, get his wife back. Didn't even understand if he was still married or not, and like, or if his wife even still loved him after being incarcerated for 5 years. Because initially with her and Andre,
And we haven't really talked about Andre, but Andre was Celestial's best friend from early childhood, and he is there with her through this whole ordeal, and then he's a little overly there with her through this ordeal. So his name keeps popping up, but he is very much there.
Yeah, they disrupted Roy's life, and Roy, they should have been together from the first. They should have been together in the first place if that's what they wanted, but he let Roy, you know. Well, I mean, that's just my personal opinion. If that was the case and they liked each other that much during that time and they were friends, I've seen this happen before. Why didn't they just go ahead and why did he let Roy step in on something he really loved? Because he made a statement. He said, why do I have to steal back something that was mine in the first place? Right. I remember him saying that in the book. And so I was just like, well, why, if it was yours in the first place, why didn't you just pursue that like you had planned on pursuing it?
Love, like, is complicated.
Yeah.
it's really complicated. And nobody owns Celestial.
Yeah. She made a point about that, too. Like, she said, like, that they described her. No one could actually own her. No one understood who she would love, you know, and rightfully so. No one should own anybody. Like, straight up.
Right. But I agree with you in the sense of, like, you know, where was all this energy at the beginning, Andre, if that's who you loved, right? But I think that's the most amazing and just unpredictable thing about love. It's just that, you know, what you're looking for is also looking for you. So maybe that wasn't her time to be with Andre.
You know, people in this racial reckoning moment would say now, I don't, yes, there's racism. And they might say, I'm starting to grasp this institutional racism and how it operates. But I think one of the brilliant things she does is she says, she takes us into the nuances of how incarceration can affect a community, a family, people's love, people's bodies, people's time, people's resources, the absence, the stigma, the ideological tensions in general. She takes us into it. And nobody is not, free of it. Now, here's the deal. She's doing this in 2021, but when we try to go back and look at the impact of the enslaved people, the lynching period, the exclusion from voting, the not allowing to be paid the same wages in the factory system, it seems to me that she's given us a way to see this. And maybe not just the impact it had on us, but the impact on people who created these systems in the first place. All right? That we might be able, since we don't want to teach the truth in schools, we don't want to teach it certainly from the standpoint of the people who were victimized, we might be able to see more clearly the inhumanity that other people have had to develop in themselves that then has had an impact on love between two people who happen to be Black. Now, I may have sounded a little romantic and a little nice because I didn't point any fingers, but I clearly want to say that inhumane systems are perpetuated by inhumane people and people who were hurt, right? And the only people who weren't hurt in this story were not just the African-American people. The larger institutions that excluded them, defined them as negative, incarcerated them, has been historical. It isn't just this moment. So I want to add that to your analysis, Andre, about it. You may not have personally been incarcerated, but which of us haven't been affected by somebody who's been incarcerated?
Absolutely.
Now, we live in Iowa, where the proportion of people of color are less, and yet we make up something, was it 41% of the incarcerated Black and brown people in the prisons? How did this happen to be that people are making their living by keeping those people contained, keeping those people policed, keeping those people educated? 98% of the teachers in this country are white women. Let's get real. I learned that from Stephanie. Or is it a little less?
It's a little less. It's more like 85, but still. I do want to add this idea that life is so unpredictable anyway. We don't even have to have a mass incarceration system for life to be unpredictable. So I think what Tayari Jones reminds me of is the fact that you can find the love of your life and be ready to move forward in things. And then here comes this. And here comes this. That did not have to happen. This did not have to happen, but yet this has to be a part of my American story as a Black couple who love each other. I think that is what she's tearing up in people's minds, is that this unpredictability of life, there are things that are impacting us and our bodies that did not have to be so.
Keisho Scott is Associate Professor of American Studies and Sociology at Grinnell College. Andre Wright is co-founder and CEO of Humanize My Hoodie. Stephanie Jones is Assistant Professor of Education at Grinnell College and the founder of the Mapping Racial Trauma in Schools Project. We have been talking about An American Marriage by Tayari Jones. Thank you to Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City for providing books to our readers. Coming up in November, we are reading My Antonia by Willa Cather. Join us for that on the air on November 16th. And please subscribe to the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast to hear other conversations like this one, as well as author interviews and bonus content. The Talk of Iowa Book Club is produced by me and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.